For the most part, they went unnoticed, though two or three random people did seem to sense that an incognito starlet might be moving in their midst. At every point along the way where the average passenger would have had to stop and deal with some slow, invasive procedure, there was a special someone stationed nearby to give the three of them a knowing wink, lift up the velvet rope, and wave them on through. Halfway into the terminal, Kyle stopped along the wall, looked furtively both ways, and then keyed open a featureless gray door. Like some portal from rural Kansas into the land of Oz, inside this door was a large VIP room with elegant furnishings and sitting areas, a bar and some bistro tables, and down the center, a privately staffed setup for dignified one-on-one security screenings. "And now, my troopers," Kyle chirped, "just a quick run through the metal detector, and then we're on to pre-boarding for a nice, cool glass of champagne. Are we holding up all right?"
"I think we're fine," Noah said. Molly breathed an Oscar-worthy sigh of impatience and leaned her head against his arm. As they approached the area with the X-ray conveyor, a TSA employee got up from his chair, put down his magazine, and sidled up to his security post. When he saw this man, Noah stopped in his tracks so suddenly that Molly bumped into him from behind.
"Is something wrong?" Kyle asked, frowning.
"Excuse us for a minute," Noah said. "I just remembered we need to make a quick phone call."
He walked Molly over to the telephone kiosk near the door they'd come in, well out of earshot of Kyle and the others.
"Damn it," he whispered.
"What is it?"
Molly asked.
"They're all over there looking at us."
"Pretend you're calling someone on the phone. I've got to think for a minute."
Molly picked up the receiver, put it to her ear, punched a few buttons, and pulled him a little closer.
"Now tell me what's going on."
"Check out the guy in the TSA outfit."
She did.
"So? Are you kidding me? That's a Star Wars geek if I ever saw one."
Maybe it was the Luke Skywalker blow cut, his mismatched socks below the nerdish cut of his high-riding uniform trousers, or the soul patch and horn-rimmed glasses, but everything about this man was screaming King of the Fanboys, and that was really bad news.
"I don't understand."
Noah lowered his voice even more. "Natalie Portman is in all three of the Star Wars prequels.
You're remembering this now?"
"I guess I hated those movies so much I'd block them out of my mind. But I'd bet my last dollar that dweeb knows Portman's face like the back of his hand. You don't understand these guys. He's probably got a candle-lit altar in front of her picture down in his mother's basement."
Molly leaned around him to take another stealthy look and swallowed hard. "What do we do?"
"I vote we get out of here and think of something else."
"No,"
she said, and it sounded like the word was final.
"We don't have time. This is it. We're here. Let's just do it."
After a last few seconds to find his nerve, he nodded, fixed her hood, and eased the brim of Molly's baseball cap down a little lower, hung up the phone for her, and then turned around to face the music. Noah went first, and he passed through the arch of the metal detector without a single blip. Kyle had stationed himself next to the X-ray tech at the luggage conveyor, no doubt ready to smoothly rationalize any oddities that might show up in his client's carry-on. Their one item, her duffel bag, went into the long machine and came out the other side with no objection raised. But the TSA man gave Noah a careful, steady look, as if he were toying with the idea of a wand sweep and a pat-down, just for good measure. Along with the recent change in alert status, an official DHS directive would have come around to remind all stations, even this special-purpose one, of the key markers for suspicious activity. Last-minute ticket purchases for one-way travel, no checked luggage, nervous or flustered behavior, identification papers not in order, and this little party matched every warning sign. Kyle cleared his throat meaningfully from where he was standing. This subtle, perfectly pitched intervention was sent to remind the room that this trip had already been pre-approved from positions much higher than their own, and these two very important people weren't to be unnecessarily troubled by the rigors of the standard inquisition. With some visible reluctance, the stern young officer nodded and gave a jut of his chin to let the first subject know he'd been provisionally cleared for boarding. So far, so good. Noah retrieved his belt and his pocket items from the gray utility tub and prepared to put on his shoes. He'd just begun to let himself believe that they were soon to be home free when the piercing tweet of the metal detector sounded off behind him. Chapter 37.
"Could you remove any metallic items and step back through for me, ma'am?"
Polite and professional though it sounded, it was a command and not a request. Kyle hurried over to escort Molly back to the far side of the electronic gauntlet again. Then he looked her up and down in search of whatever offending metal might have set off the alert. In all the rush, she'd forgotten about the cell phone in her pocket. Kyle took that and then delicately helped her remove her necklace, bracelet, and the ring on her finger. He placed those items in a tray held out by the officer, and then nodded to her to indicate that all was ready for another try. Molly walked slowly through the arch again. The vertical line of indicator lights twitched upward from dark green to barely yellow, maybe in reaction to the tiny hinges in her sunglasses, but this time there was no audible alarm. Noah was the only one in a position to notice a touch of private relief on Molly's face. She was nearly to the end of the exit track of the detector when she was stopped by the officer's voice.
"Miss Portman?"
When Molly turned around, she must have seen exactly what Noah was seeing. The TSA man wasn't focused on her at all. He was staring down at her possessions in his plastic tray.
"Yes," she said softly.
Now he looked up at her and raised his hand slowly above the tray. Molly's silver necklace with its little silver cross was dangling from the knuckle of his thumb.
"I thought," the officer said, "that you were Jewish."
It felt like the temperature in the room suddenly dropped by 50 degrees. Noah's mouth went totally dry, his skin tingling as though all the moisture had flash-frozen out of the atmosphere, settling into a thin layer of frost on everything exposed, suspending those 6 words on the air. Cops know liars like plumbers know leaks. They encounter them every day, all day. They know all the little signs and symptoms, and they're trained to understand that where there's even a little whiff of smoke, one should always assume there's a fire. As they challenge a person, they study their reactions, pick apart the little telltale movements, listen to the timbre of the voice, and more than anything else, they watch the eyes. Most suspects have already made a full confession by the time they begin their denial. This was one of the topics of light conversation in the wee hours of that first night when he and Molly had met. Noah had been so fascinated by the woman that he hadn't stopped to wonder why she seemed to know so much about the art of deception. "Don't be afraid," she had said. "That's the key, no matter how bad it gets. If locked in a car that's speeding toward a gap in the bridge and it's clearly too late to stop, most people would still waste their last mortal seconds stepping on the brakes. But what you really want to do is say a little prayer and then floor it. If you're going to go down anyway, go all in, go down with courage, because, hey, there's always that one slim chance that you'll make it to the other side." From behind her, Noah saw Molly's head tilt slightly, and this movement was accompanied by a subtle hip shift. There was a convex security mirror on a bracket above the metal detector, and in that reflection he saw a patient but serious expression on her face that meant, "You didn't really just say what I think I heard, did you?" The officer appeared unfazed.
"Would you take off your sunglasses for me, please?" he said.
That's all, folks. Curtains. Checkmate. Game over. Noah hoped only that his upcoming visit to prison would be more enjoyable than his first. He'd already begun to gauge the running distance to the door when Molly looked back at him. She appeared to be perfectly serene, and she mouthed something to him. He wasn't much of a lip reader, and it took his panic-stricken mind a few seconds to recognize her message. It had been the short phrase that's always at the top of any good list of famous last words. "Watch this." She turned to the officer, pulled back her hood and let it settle onto her shoulders, removed the baseball cap and let it fall to the floor at her feet, and then, slow and sure, began to walk toward him.
"The force is strong with this one,"
Molly said, as calm and smooth as a Jedi master. Her accent was gone, and her voice was just breathy enough to obscure any other identifying qualities of the real McCoy. The TSA man's cheeks began to redden slightly. A power shift was underway, and as Noah had learned firsthand, when this girl turned it on, you never knew what was about to hit you. She continued nearer, put a finger to the frames and lowered her sunglasses partway down her nose, tipping her chin so she could look at the officer directly, eye to eye, just over the top of the darkened lenses. As she stopped barely a foot away, she subtly passed an open hand between their faces and spoke again. "These aren't the droids you're looking for," Molly said. After waiting a moment, she gave him a little nod, as though it had come time in their close-up scene for his own line of dialogue. There was an eternal pause, and then, before his eyes, Noah saw this big, intimidating young man begin his grinning transformation from the TSA's most vigilant watchdog into Natalie Portman's biggest fan. "These aren't the droids we're looking for," the officer repeated her words just as that spellbound stormtrooper had said them at the Imperial checkpoint in Episode 4. After holding his rapt gaze for a few more seconds, Molly pulled out the secret weapon more fearsome than any lightsaber, that sweet, wicked smile that made your knees feel like they could bend in all directions. She slipped the pen from his pocket protector, clicked it, took the hand that still held her necklace, and autographed his palm with an artful flourish. "Bravo!" Kyle said, and his light applause was picked up by all the other employees who had turned their attention that way. That put a button at the end of the crisis. Before any further delay could threaten his schedule, he bustled around and retrieved her duffel bag along with her cap, phone, and jewelry. Then with a cheerful, over-the-shoulder, "Thank you, everyone!" he gathered his clients back under his wing and hurried them to the exit door. They were to board the plane from the flight crew's side stairway out on the tarmac. When they got outside, Noah motioned to Kyle that he needed just a minute with his girl. Their escort nodded and moved off to a discreet distance, pausing only to tap the face of his watch as a reminder to be quick before he turned away to wait. "How did I do?" Molly asked, obviously fully aware of exactly how she'd done. "You quoted two different male characters from the wrong trilogy, but other than that, you nailed it." "I wrote a midterm paper on the first two movies in college. Never saw any of the others."
"Film class?"
"Political science." He had to wait for a noisy vehicle to pass before he could speak again. "I need to ask you something," Noah said.
"Sure."
It seemed she could see that he'd become more somber.
"When we were there in Times Square, when we kissed that time."
She took off the sunglasses and hooked them on her pocket, moved a little closer to him, brushed a windblown lock of hair from his eyes.
"I remember."
"Is that when you pickpocketed my BlackBerry?" Molly smiled and pulled him willingly into her embrace. It was no real surprise, but this kiss was every bit as stirring as that first one had been, and as he realized then for certain, as good as every single one would be thereafter. She stood back a step, her face as innocent as a newborn lamb, and held up his wallet between them.
"I love you," Noah said.
Molly looked up at him with all the courageous resolve of the doomed Han Solo at the end of The Empire Strikes Back.
"I know," she replied.
By the time the jet reached its cruising altitude, Molly had fallen sound asleep in his arms. They had the entire row to themselves, and the crew had taken excellent care of them so far. Now it was quiet, and in the remains of this day, a little peace and stillness were more than welcome. Molly had taken only one thing from her bag to keep with her during the four-hour flight. He recognized the book as the hand-bound journal she'd shown him back in her apartment downtown. It would be nice to have something to read, he thought, and after a brief consideration he decided that she wouldn't be likely to object if he took a look through her little book as she slept. Folded just inside the front cover, he found the pencil drawing that had been pinned to her bedroom wall, that idyllic sketch of her someday cabin in the woods. On the next page was the beginning of the texts she'd been given by the Founder's Keepers, that portion of the writings from early American history she was meant to preserve and memorize on their behalf. Thomas Jefferson, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. What followed didn't really seem to comprise the most famous or succinct of Jefferson's writings. Rather, it was as though a great deal of his written legacy, maybe all of it, had been distributed among quite a number of people, and Molly's was only a small, random part placed in her care. Accordingly, the first section consisted of Jefferson's second inaugural address. Noah read through a portion of it. I fear not that any motives of interest may lead me astray. I am sensible of no passion which could seduce me knowingly from the path of justice. But the weaknesses of human nature and the limits of my own understanding will produce errors of judgment sometimes injurious to your interests. I shall need, therefore, all the indulgence which I have heretofore experienced from my constituents. The want of it will certainly not lessen with increasing years. What struck Noah as he read these words was a fundamental difference in tone from the political discourse of later times. Here was one of the founders of the nation, maybe the greatest thinker among them, and yet he spoke with a quality that was so rare today as to be almost extinct among modern public servants. It was a profound humility, as though nothing were more important to express than the honor he felt in being chosen again as a guardian of the people's precious liberties. There was a great deal more to read. Noah held his place, looked down at Molly, and found her still sleeping. He adjusted the light above him so it was less likely to disturb her rest. Then he remembered something else that he'd been meaning to ask her if they'd only had a moment to breathe. Nothing important, but he was curious. Of all the remote destinations Molly could have picked for her flight to safety, anywhere in the world, really, he wondered why she'd chosen Las Vegas. Chapter 38. Danny Bailey and Agent Kearns had been on the road in their bomb-laden van for nearly 5 hours straight, and they were past due for a fuel stop and a stretch. After taking his turn in the gas station's cramped restroom, Danny picked up a diet soda and a candy bar and brought them to the counter. As the cashier was ringing him up, he scanned the visible stories on a bundled stack of newspapers off to the side. Two headlines stood out, and he read them over again. Nationwide terror alert status elevated once more. DHS chief, Intel confirms credible threat for Western U.S. He looked up into the corner and saw a dusty security camera looking back down at him. Even out here, he thought, on the outskirts of civilization, some backward, distant cousin of Big Brother is still watching. From that odd camera angle, Danny's fuzzy, jerky image was displayed on a small black-and-white TV on the side shelf, wedged between the cigarettes and a rack of dog-eared porno magazines. "I'll take one of these, too," he said, holding up the paper. Stuart Kearns walked past him toward the door, still rubbing his hands dry. "Let's go, kid! We're burning daylight!" Danny nodded an acknowledgement, but the words and their urgency had barely intruded on his running thoughts. A few seconds later, the cashier had to nudge his hand to snap him out of it, and he picked up his bagged purchases and his change and headed for the van. As the trip progressed southward, the Nevada roads had gradually become more and more rustic and empty of traffic. From the first wide interstate to four-lane turnpikes, down to the aging two-lane desert highway they'd now been on for a good while, in a sense it felt as though they were traveling further back in time with every passing mile. At this rate, they'd be bumping down a mule trail before sunset. Danny still had the newspaper he'd bought draped across his lap, though he'd stopped reading it several minutes before. "Can I run something up the flagpole, Stuart?"
"Sure."
"The terrorism alert is elevated. I take that back. It was already elevated 2 days ago, and now it's been raised again."
"Right."
"They're talking here," he tapped the paper, "about what they call a specific, credible threat, maybe two, that they're tracking somewhere in the western United States. They're already stopping and searching cars at all the bridges in San Francisco." Kearns looked over, then put his attention back on the road.
"What are you getting at?"
"Put on your tinfoil hat for a minute, and I'll tell you."
Okay, go."
You remember the 7/7 bombings in 2005?
Of course.
Do you know that a security company with a former Scotland Yard guy in charge was running a terrorism drill in London that very morning? And this random drill involving 1,000 people was planned out months in advance to simulate the same kind of bombing incidents on the same targets on the same day and at the same times.
No, I didn't know that.
And then it really happened. While they were running the drill, the exact actual thing they were practicing for actually freaking happened. What are the odds of that being a coincidence?
If any of that were true, Kearns said, I'd know about it.
So what does that tell you, Oliver Stone?
Well then, Danny went on, undaunted, do you know that the guy your old friends in the U.S. government believe was the actual mastermind of those bombings, his name is Haroon Rashid Azwat, was also some sort of protected double agent who was on the payroll of some obscure faction of MI6? The CIA knew all about him, but they weren't allowed to touch him. He even lived over here for a few years. Hell, he tried to organize an Al-Qaeda training camp in Oregon.
You're a real piece of work. You know that?
One more thing. The guy that we haven't seen yet, his name is Elmer, right?
Right.
The guy in charge on September 11th was Mohammed Atta. He had a lot of aliases, and that's the one he started using after 2000 when he got into the United States. He was born Mohammed El-Amir Awad al-Sayed Atta Karadoğan. But the name on his work visa, the one he showed when he enrolled in flight school in Florida, was Mohammed El-Amir.
And El-Amir sounds like Elmer, Kearns said. Do you take a nap during the day? Because you must stay up all night thinking about this crap.
In English, El-Amir translates to the general. It could be a code word. Atta used El-Amir back then in 2001, and this guy's using it now. If this whole thing is part of some false flag operation, if they're really trying to bring this war back home, they need a new boogeyman right here on U.S. soil. And they need to connect him to past events and to the Patriot movement so they can demonize the resistance.
Mohammed Atta is dead.
Yeah, so is Osama bin Laden, but that doesn't stop him from putting out a tape every 6 months. And I'm not even saying it's a real live Islamo-fascist behind any of this, but making it look that way will make the story that much scarier when something happens.
Look, Kearns said, I'll tell you one thing I do know. There's an election coming up, and fear has been a swing factor in party politics for as long as I can remember. The timing of this whole thing, the terror alert, and all the rest of it, it wouldn't surprise me one bit to find out after all this is over that we're just playing a bit part in somebody else's political ambitions. Technically, I guess you could call that a conspiracy if it makes you happy.
It didn't make him happy, but Danny decided to let it lie. How much farther now? He asked. Kearns checked his watch and then glanced at the screen of the GPS.
About a half hour, maybe less.
As the ride went on in silence, Danny looked across occasionally at the older man, hoping that he'd at least planted a seed of warning. In that small way it seemed he'd been successful. You can't see another man's thoughts, but you can sure see him thinking. Chapter 39. The fastened seatbelt light had just blinked on above Noah's head, accompanied by an intercom announcement that the flight would soon begin its on-time descent into McCarran International. He rubbed his eyes, and they felt as though he hadn't blinked in quite a while. The time had apparently flown by as he'd been occupied reading and rereading the many quoted passages that filled the pages of Molly's book. In the course of his supposedly top-shelf schooling, he must have already been exposed to much of this, and if so, it shouldn't have seemed as new to him as it did. And in a strange, unsettling way, like reading a horoscope so accurate that its author must surely have been watching you for months through the living room window, it seemed that each of these writings was addressed to this current time and this very place for the sole specific benefit of Noah Gardner. There had been many examples, but this was one that stood out. The phrase, too big to fail, had been reborn for propaganda purposes during a brainstorming session at the office last year. This was in the run-up to the country's massive financial meltdown, the multi-phase disaster that was only now gathering its full head of steam. The original purpose of the phrase in business was to describe an entity that was, literally, too large and successful to possibly go under. Think of the Titanic, only before the iceberg. But this newly minted meaning, it was decided, would be a threat rather than a promise. While the crisis had, in truth, of course, been nothing less than a blatant sweeping consolidation of wealth and power, perpetrated by some of Doyle and Merchant's most prestigious Wall Street clients, it wouldn't do to allow the press and the public to perceive it that way. So the government's bailout of these billionaire speculators and their legion of cronies and accomplices was instead presented as a bold rescue, undertaken for the good of the American people themselves. "We have no choice." That was the sad, helpless tone of both the givers and the receivers of those hundreds of billions of dollars, monies to be deducted directly from the dreams of a brighter future for coming generations. AIG, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Citi, Bear Stearns, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Fannie and Freddie, and the all-powerful puppet master behind it all, Goldman Sachs. These companies are the only underpinnings of our whole way of life, so the breathless story went, and if they go down, we all do. It was a fresh way of presenting the public with a familiar choice, the lesser among evils. There was talk of a death spiral drop in the stock market, a wildfire of bank runs and wholesale foreclosures, even martial law was threatened from the floor of Congress if the bailout failed to pass. These were the alibis repeated by the PR pundits and the complicit men and women in our supposedly representative government when they were asked, "Why did you do it?" The choice they made was to reward the corruption, but all of them knew the better answer, or should have. It didn't take a 1,000-page bill to get it across. "Let justice be done, though the heavens fall." In Molly's book, this quote was unattributed, but the ideal it conveyed was ancient and the central pillar of the rule of law. Thomas Paine, quoted on the same page, had put it a different way in Common Sense. "In America, the law is king." Even the most powerful can't place themselves above it, the weakest are never beneath its protection, and no corrupt institution is too big to fail. So that's what a principle is, Noah thought, as though he were pondering the word for the very first time. It's not a guideline, or a suggestion, or one of many weighty factors to be parsed in a complex intellectual song and dance. It's a cornerstone in the foundation, the bedrock that a great structure is built upon. Everything else can come crashing down around us, because those fleeting things can always be rebuilt even better than they were before. But if we hold to it, the principle will still be standing, so we can start again. Next down this page was John Adams' take on something Noah's father had told him only that morning. "The desire of dominion, that great principle by which we have attempted to account for so much good and so much evil, is, when properly restrained, a very useful and noble movement in the human mind. But when such restraints are taken off, it becomes an encroaching, grasping, restless, and ungovernable power. Numberless have been the systems of iniquity contrived by the great for the gratification of this passion in themselves." In short, governments have proven that they always go bad because they're made up of imperfect people. But unlike Arthur Gardner, Adams believed that that impossible puzzle had been solved by the ingenious separation of powers at the heart of his new country's design. Or rather, it was given to the people to solve it every single day, at every election, in the ever-wary supervision of their dangerous servants. On the facing page was a quote from another Adams, a cousin of John, and it had been written much larger and bolder than the surrounding text. It was a challenge that Samuel Adams had laid down as the nascent revolution was nearing its point of no return, a gut check for all those who would call themselves Americans. "If you love wealth greater than liberty, the tranquility of servitude greater than the animating contest for freedom, go home from us in peace. We seek not your counsel, nor your arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. May your chain set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you were our countrymen. Put up or shut up, in other words, go hard or go home. Freedom is the rare exception, he was saying, not the rule. And if you want it, you've got to do your part to keep it. The plane touched down on the runway with barely a jolt, and soon began to slow for its turn toward the arrival gate. Something touched Noah's leg, and he looked up from his reading. Molly was finally awakening from her nap. As she finished a languid stretch, he passed her a bottle of water.
Thanks, she said. I didn't mean to sleep this whole time.
You must have needed it. Molly noticed the book in his hands. He closed it and handed it to her. I hope you don't mind that I was reading this.
No, not at all.
She pulled her bag from under the seat, zipped it open, and returned the book to a sleeve inside.
Hey, Molly? Yes?
He touched her hand.
I think I get it now, Noah said. You get what?
I really didn't before, but I understand what you're doing now, you and your people.
Oh,
she nodded and continued to check over her things.
I mean it.
I know you do, she said, in the way you might address an overly needy child in recognition of some minor accomplishment.
Good. I'm glad.
He didn't know what response he'd expected when he told her of his newfound understanding, but it wasn't this. There'd hardly been enough of a reaction to qualify as one. Before long, the plane had reached the gate, and the door nearest them was the first to be opened. She was walking ahead of him in the exit tunnel, as though with some purpose that she hadn't paused to share. He caught up to her as she stopped to scan an informational display with a backlit map of airport services.
I say we grab a meal, Noah said. Spend the night, and then try to figure something out tomorrow.
His suggestion was overlooked as if he hadn't spoken it at all.
I need for you to help me rent a car, Molly said.
Chapter 40.
This must be the place, Danny said.
He folded the printout of directions and slipped them into a side pocket of the door. According to the map and the van's odometer, the rendezvous location for the final exchange was right here, somewhere off to the side of the faded gravel road. Out his passenger window, there was nothing much to see but a flat expanse of desert and some faraway mountains at the horizon. Kearns tapped him on the leg.
Over here.
The stark landscape had begun to take on warmer hues as the sun got low, but there was still enough daylight to see things clearly, provided you were shown where to look. Way off to the driver's side, maybe 300 yards distant, Danny saw what looked like the only man-made thing for miles around. Whatever it wasn't much. No trail led out there, and this vehicle wasn't made to go off-road. Kern seemed to know what he was doing, though. He made a careful turn toward their final destination. As they got close, the scene became clearer. Danny saw the rear ends of two vehicles, a car and a mid-size unmarked yellow cargo truck, both of which were parked behind a square, gray, one-story building. Building was an overstatement, actually. The simple 10-foot-high enclosure appeared to be made of nothing but cinder blocks and dark mortar. There was an open, arched doorway, but no roof overhead. About a stone's throw away from the main structure, in a perfectly spaced circle surrounding the building on all sides, were a number of bizarre, freestanding walls and angled edifices jutting up out of the sand. Some looked like backstops from a playground handball court, one like the black alien monolith from 2001 A Space Odyssey. The layout reminded him a little of Stonehenge, but only if Stonehenge had been built over one hurried weekend by an amateur bricklayer on acid.
What the hell is this place? Danny asked.
Out here you never know. This part of Nevada's full of surprises.
Agent Kern stopped the van well away from the other vehicles and put the shifter into park.
It could be something the military threw together for part of a nuclear test.
could be a target for a bombing range that used to run through here?"
He clapped Danny lightly on the shoulder.
"What do you think? Are you ready for this?"
"I already told you what I think."
"Don't worry so much," Kearns said, "or you're going to look nervous. Listen, this is a milk run. We'll be in and out of here in 5 minutes, and then we'll go get us a hot dog and a cold beer before I drop you off at the airport."
He'd stopped talking because something had caught his attention out the front windshield. One of the men they were meeting had appeared by the corner of the main cinder block building, and with a broad gesture he beckoned them to come on over. Another of the men was behind the first, standing there with an assault rifle slung over his shoulder.
"Okay, then," Danny sighed. "Let's rock."
He opened the door, stepped out, and waved back to the guy who'd greeted them, then put on the light jacket Kearns had loaned him. It was a size too large, but that was fine for his purposes. He reached in and slipped Kearns's satellite phone from its charger on the console and put it in the left-hand pocket, then flipped open the glove box and removed the pistol.
"Do you have an extra clip for this?"
"No, I don't. What are you doing?"
The pistol went snugly into Danny's belt in back, not in the middle but closer to the right side. The long jacket hid it completely.
"I'm getting ready for this whole thing to go to hell in a handbasket. If everything's fine, you can say I told you so. But in the meantime, if I can make a suggestion, why don't you take that .38 out of your ankle holster and put it where you can get it if you need it?"
Thankfully, the older man was listening, and even if he wasn't quite convinced that there was going to be trouble, he was at least open-minded enough to move his small revolver to the right-hand pocket of his bomber jacket.
"I thought you said you didn't know much about guns," Kearns said.
"That's not what I said. I said I wasn't an expert."
Expert wasn't a term to be bandied about among Danny's gun-savvy friends. An expert might be someone who could call their shot from 10 yards and then, from a cold start, draw their pistol from concealment and put a bullet right where they said it would go, all in 7/10 of a second or less. Molly Ross was one of those, and a few years back, over one hot and memorable Tennessee summer, she'd taught him everything he knew. He'd been getting even more death threats than usual that year, and she'd wanted him to be safe. So, while he wasn't an expert, his draw was pretty fast. It was the part about hitting what he shot at that still left a lot to be desired.
"Okay," Kearns said.
His demeanor was a bit more grim than it had been a few minutes before.
"Let's do it."
Chapter 41. Their model bomb wasn't that heavy, maybe 80 or 100 pounds, but it was unwieldy to carry between them. When they came within sight of the men they were here to meet, and like last time, there were only 4 of them, not the expected 5, one of them motioned to a spot on the ground to show where they should leave their burden. When they got to that spot, they put it down. One of the other men had a brand-new-looking satchel at his feet, a bag of the sort that might be holding their $20,000 for the exchange. The last 2 men were the ones with the automatic rifles. The weapons these guys were sporting appeared to be some knocked-together variant of an AR-15, but with a very short barrel, stock target sights, custom noise suppression, and a non-standard magazine. Good luck trying to buy something like that off the shelf. Not the most versatile choice for all-purpose combat, obviously laughable for hunting or target practice, but flip it to full auto, and it would do every bit as well as a sawed-off shotgun for anti-personnel work at close quarters. Situations like this one, for example. The armed man to the left held his gun like he'd been born with it in his hands. The other one didn't seem at all at ease, either with his weapon or his assigned enforcer's role. His hands were deep in his pockets, and his rifle hung haphazardly by its sling over his shoulder, as though it had been put there against his will and he had no desire to deal with it. Upon their arrival, Kearns had made a bit of small talk with each member of the group, and soon all agreed it was time to do the deal they'd come to do.
"Here's your money," said the man on the end.
He'd introduced himself as Randy at their meeting the previous night. As Kearns walked over to retrieve the satchel, Randy motioned to his men to pick up their merchandise and stow it in the back of the cargo truck. The rear door was opened, and 2 of them carefully carried the bomb up the mover's ramp, set it down, and flipped on a hanging work light in the compartment to check over their purchase. Meanwhile, Kearns had come back with the satchel to stand at Danny's side.
"Ain't you gonna count it?"
This deadpan question came from one of the guys with the guns, the one doing his level best to come off like a natural-born badass. Kearns shrugged.
"If we're short, at least I know where to find you guys tomorrow morning. Am I right?"
That brought a little chuckle from everyone except the man who'd spoken up. Danny's attention was on the other contents that were now visible in the truck's rear compartment. Down the center, on a welded-together waist-high metal rack, was what appeared to be a long, silvery torpedo. Not really, though. The nose was too blunt and flat, and its far end was tapered and ringed by large aerodynamic fins. It looked like something from a war museum, an overbuilt piece of heavy-duty airdropped ordnance from a bygone era of the Cold War. That wasn't all. Tucked back in the corner, away from the light, something was wrapped up and bound in a black plastic tarp on the floor. It could have been a lot of things, but to Danny's current frame of mind, what it looked like most was an occupied body bag. He glanced at Kearns, and by all appearances he was seeing the same thing. A loud ringtone from the phone on the belt of the man named Randy broke the silence. He held up a polite index finger as if to say, "Sorry, I've got to take this," turned, took a half step away, and answered. And that, Danny thought, would be a call from El Amir. Kearns bent and put the satchel down between them, shivered a bit, breathed some warm air through his hands, and then put them into his jacket pockets. When he looked at Danny just for a second or two, there was such a crystal-clear communication between them that he almost heard the words form in his head.
"You were right. Now we're going to let these guys give us just one more bad sign, the tiniest sign, and then we put their lights out. No freeze, FBI! No warning shots. We shoot to kill until they're all down or we are, and you and I both know who gets it first."
Danny took his right hand from his pocket, casually scratched the side of his nose, feigned a leisurely yawn, and then let his arm hang back down by his side. Randy, the one still on the phone, looked back over his shoulder. He was listening intently, not talking. His eyes went first to Stuart Kearns, and then over to Danny, and then he turned back around with his back to them as he'd been before. A few more seconds passed, and still facing away, Randy's free hand came up slowly and touched the shoulder of the man to his right, the mouthy guy who looked like he just couldn't wait for the lead to start flying. And that was it. When you've practiced enough, it gets to look like one fluid motion, but there are four distinct parts to a quick draw, at least to the one that Molly had taught him. In the beginning, the count is slow and you stop between the steps so your teacher can make sure you've got them right. After a few months and several thousand repeats, though, it starts to go so fast that if you blink, you might miss it. Danny's right hand swept back to clear his clothing and found the pistol grip just where he'd left it. He pulled the weapon free and brought it forward, the barrel coming parallel to the ground and his left hand joining the solid grasp. He extended toward center mass of his target with the iron sight rising level to his eye, and at the end of the forward movement, as it all came together at his ideal firing position, without a pause, he squeezed the trigger to its stop. The boom of their first two shots was almost simultaneous, though Kearns had a much easier draw from his pocket. They'd chosen the same primary target, the man to whom Randy had given his too obvious go-ahead, the guy who would have cut them in half with a hail of bullets if they'd given him half a chance to shoot first. As Kearns took off to his left, still firing, their designated executioner was crumpling backward, likely dead on his feet, but surely out of commission. Danny broke right, aiming by the seat of his pants and squeezing off another shot as soon as any one of the scattering men appeared in his line of fire. He was a below-average marksman on a static range, but now he and his targets were moving, and they were starting to return fire, so he was shooting a lot but not hitting much of anything. But at least he'd gotten their full attention. In the next moment, he ran out of ammo and good ideas at the very same time as the second man with the heavy artillery had finally found his wits and started shooting. A jagged line of bullet impacts stitched across the sand toward him, and as Danny dropped to the ground in a shallow gully, he heard a tire explode and the windows shatter in their van just behind him. He saw Stuart Kearns step from behind the cover of one of the random concrete walls, and the FBI man made his next four rounds count. As the last gunshots echoed back from the mountains, three of the men were lying motionless on the ground, and one was unaccounted for, but only for the moment. The silence was broken by the sound of a diesel engine turning over and starting. Danny watched Kearns limping toward the back of the truck, then grabbing on and hoisting himself up into the open compartment. As the truck dropped into gear and started to roll, Danny got to his feet and ran for it. The faster he ran, the faster it went, and it had nearly accelerated to the point of no return when he caught up to the tailgate, stumbled forward to get a grasp onto Stuart Kearns' extended hand, and felt himself pulled up and in. Chapter 42. Noah had shaken his one remaining pill out of the prescription bottle halfway through the flight, and now, as the last of the medicine was wearing off, a nasty withdrawal was setting in with a vengeance. By the time they reached the car rental counter, he could feel himself starting to fade. Headache, chills, dizziness, a general sickening malaise. It was already bad, and he could tell it was going to get much worse over the next few hours. Molly was driving, since he clearly wasn't fit to sit behind the wheel, and to put it delicately, she drove with a purpose. If he'd been feeling good and in the right sort of daredevil mood, her driving might have been easier to take in stride. As it was, though, between his worsening physical condition and being jostled around the front seat by all the surging and braking and swerving through traffic, he wasn't having any fun at all. Plus, she wasn't talking. Since they'd started out in the car, all he was getting were one-word answers, along with clear, unspoken signals that there was nothing so important that it needed to be discussed at the moment. They'd left the city limits of Las Vegas over half an hour ago, so his hope of a good night's recovery in a 5-star bed was more than 30 miles behind them and fading fast. According to the speedometer, wherever she was taking them, she was trying to get there in way too much of a hurry. "We're going to get stopped," Noah said. She didn't answer, and she didn't slow down. "Where are we going, Molly?" "To help a friend," she said curtly. "Now would you please just let me drive?" "Fine. Thank you." Before long, they'd left the main highway and were barreling down some narrow desert road that was only a thin single line on the GPS screen. Before they'd gotten started, she'd spent quite a bit of time and frustration entering their destination into the device. It was hard, she'd said, because it wasn't a street address that she'd been given, only a latitude and longitude. The sheet of paper from which she'd read those coordinates was still tucked into one of the cup holders. Okay, then. If she didn't want to take a few seconds to tell him what was going on, he could damn well figure it out for himself. Before she could stop him, Noah picked up the sheet and opened it up, tapped on the overhead map light, and held the paper near his eyes. What was printed there appeared to be two cut-and-pasted text messages, or emails, he couldn't tell which. Maybe it was because his mind was working only at half capacity, but he had to read it all over twice. The first time through, he couldn't accept what he was seeing. "Molly, spread the word. Stay away from Las Vegas Monday. FBI sting op. Exigent. Be safe. XOXO. DB. FYI only. Do not forward. Delete after reading. Big meeting today, Monday, PM, Southern Nevada. If you don't hear from me by Wednesday, I'm probably dead. Asterisk. I wish I was kidding. And this is where to hunt for the body. Latitude 37 degrees, 39 minutes, 54.35 seconds north. Longitude 116 degrees, 56 minutes, 31.48 seconds west. Stay away from Nevada. TFN. DB. Unbelievable! She glanced over at him, but only for a second before she got her eyes back on the road. When he looked down, he found he'd crumpled the paper in his hand so hard that it might never come unfolded. "I can't believe it," Noah said. "You people got me again!" Chapter 43. 911, this call is recorded. What's your emergency? Wherever they were going, the ride was awfully rough. Danny was holding on tight to a cargo strap near the open door at the rear of the moving truck, the only place in the metal compartment with a signal solid enough to make a call on Kearns's satellite phone.
"My name is Danny Bailey. I'm out in the desert somewhere northwest of Las Vegas, and I'm with FBI Special Agent Stuart Kearns. I'm in the back of a truck that's on the move, and this truck belongs to a terrorist organization that might have their hands on a nuclear weapon."
"What's your location, sir?"
"Listen, I know what you people can do. You already know where I am better than I do. You know whose phone I'm calling from. You know the route I'm on, and in about 10 seconds you'll be sure who I am because you'll have verified my voice print. So stop wasting my time."
Some odd noise broke onto the line for a time. Not interference, but a series of electronic clicks, tones, and dropouts.
"Okay, good deal. Is everybody on now? Everybody listening? This is about an operation codenamed Exigent. Did you get that? Exigent. So now you know who I am, who I'm with, why I'm here, and where to send the cavalry. And you'd by God better know this is for real. Just follow this signal down and get here. Understand?"
He left the phone switched on and placed it in a niche on the bed of the cargo compartment. Kearns was near the front wall, kneeling next to the tarp-wrapped bundle they'd both seen earlier, before the shooting had started. It was a body, of course, and the face of the dead man had been uncovered. When Kearns turned to look at him, Danny didn't have to ask who it was that was lying there. He had already known who it would be. Agent Kearns had said that after these last few years of working this operation undercover, all the while doing his best to appear to be a raving militant agitator who'd turned against his government and was openly calling for a violent revolution, he really had only one remaining contact in the FBI. His frightening online persona was well known to tens of thousands of fringe group wackos and law enforcement personnel alike. But only one person alive could have credibly testified that Stuart Kearns was actually a loyal American doing his duty to protect and defend the United States. And here was that person, dead.
"Did you call 911? Kearns asked.
"Yeah, I did. And now they'll either come or they won't."
"What do you mean by that?"
Danny touched the metal gantry next to him, the frame that held the thing that at first glance he'd thought might be a torpedo. "Take a look at this thing with me and tell me what you think." As Kearns moved to stand, he winced and leaned his head back against the corrugated wall of the compartment. Below the knee, his right pants leg was stained with blood.
"Are you okay?"
"I'll be fine. Just help me up."
They stood on either side of the framework, bracing themselves on its crossbars as the truck moved over the rough road they were traveling.
"This looks like an old Mark 8 atomic bomb," Kearns said, "from the early 1950s.
He pulled the light down closer and ran his hands over the surface, stopping at a series of seals and stickers that carried dates and the initials of inspectors.
"It's been maintained all these years."
"So this is a live one, then?"
"Sure looks that way to me."
A line of heavy metal conduit ran from the rear of the thing, and Kearns followed it with a finger, pointing. The tubing went across the floor and through the wall to the driver's compartment.
"And it looks like they've jury-rigged it to be set off from the front seat."
"So your guy over there on the floor, he brought them this one, and you brought yours. You both got managed so you didn't know what the other was doing, and we all got set up at once."
"But why?"
Kearns said. He wasn't really asking, he was thinking it through. "It's like I told you before. Whoever's behind this needed a patsy for a false flag domestic attack, Stuart, and that's you. And they needed to make my people the enemy, and that's why I'm here."
"Based on your file, they could have had you picked up any time they wanted, but they picked you up Friday night to make you a part of this. And me, they've just kept me in cold storage.
Waiting for the right time, when they needed a couple of fall guys," Danny said. "The crazy internet conspiracy theorist who incited these thugs into violence, and the lone nut ex-FBI man who helped them pull it off."
"Well, whoever's behind this, we've screwed up their plans for now."
"But not for too much longer. This guy's driving somewhere like he means to get where he's going, but if he calms down long enough to stop and come back here to check his load, we're toast. We're unarmed, and he'll just stand back and shoot us like fish in a barrel. Then he'll go on to Vegas tonight and do what he's going to do. We can't wait for him to do that.
Kearns looked up at him.
So what do we do?
The truck slowed briefly, made a turn onto what felt like a much smoother roadway, and then began to pick up speed again.
I've got an idea, Danny said, but I don't know if you'll like it.
He walked toward the tailgate where the package they'd brought was strapped against the side of the compartment and motioned for his partner to follow. When Kearns had sat and situated his injured leg, Danny crouched down and pulled off the tarp that was covering the device. He peeled off the keys that were taped near the arming panel and handed them to Kearns. If one of these bombs was real, then it stood to reason that they both were real. And there was really only one way to find out.
Here we go, Kearns said.
He inserted the two keys into the control panel, twisted them a quarter turn, and pressed the button labeled ARM. The line of yellow bulbs illuminated, winked to green one by one as the soft whine from the charging electronics ascended up the scale. Once the device had gotten its bearings, it was simple enough to reset the final destination on the touchscreen of the GPS detonator. It wasn't an address they selected, of course, just an empty point on the deserted road they were traveling, a little less than 3 miles ahead and counting down. The older man lit up a cigarette, and he shook another one up from the pack and offered it across.
Nah, I told you, Danny said. I quit 5 years ago.
Ah, come on. Special occasion.
I took an oath to an old friend, Stuart, and if you met this woman, you'd know why I can't break it.
When you put it that way, I guess I see what you mean.
Kearns winced and straightened his leg, leaned his head back against the corrugated wall of the compartment, eyes closed.
Hey, Danny said, and he waited until his partner looked over. The other night when you were telling me about your career with the FBI, you said that after all they'd put you through, you wondered sometimes why you stuck it out.
Yeah?
This is why, man. Tonight is why you stayed on. What was it they had you say when you put your hand on the Bible and they swore you in?
It's been so long, let's see if I even remember. I do solemnly swear, Kearns said quietly, that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
Damn right.
And how about you?
Me? Oh, this is the perfect way for me to go out, really. The more I think about it, the more I realize I must have outstayed my welcome in my own movement. I take that back. It's not even mine anymore. If guys like these can agree with anything I say, then I've been saying something wrong. And you know what, Stuart? A long time ago I pledged my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor to this country. And now I get to give all three of them at once.
Kearns took a last drag and stubbed out his smoke on the metal floor.
Does it matter that nobody will ever know?